Welcome to the Weird Thing podcast, episode 13, Ross Rant, part 1. I am Jochem, and today I will talk with Rich and our special guest Ross about the role of academics in modern heathenry. Ross, maybe you can start with a short introduction who you are.
Hi Jochem. So my name is Ross Downing. I'm from the UK, and I've lived in Scandinavia for the past 20 years or so. I first got involved in heathenry as a teenager. I was a member of the folkish group called the Odinic Rite, which is, and specifically the one that now became the Odinist Fellowship. I was a Gothi, and I eventually left. And then when I came to Sweden, I was a Gothi and member of the Swedish Azotru Association, which is now called Fornsed Sweden. I've moved away from that group over the years for no particular reason. But now I'm really more an internet heathen or a solitary heathen. And I was involved in creating Declaration 127 with Zan Folmer. And generally, I like to be involved in supporting like heathen groups and initiatives and things. On my academic side, I've got a master's in the study of Old Norse religion and a second master's in the study of contemporary paganism, specifically modern heathenry. And I'm active in both fields of study. I publish academically and I present at conferences and things like that. And I currently work for a UK-based NGO called Inform, and we're located in the Religious Studies Department at King's College in London. And we research and document and advise the UK Home Office on new religious movements like cults and sects and things. And I'm an editor and producer for them in a forthcoming book on Bloomsbury Publishing, and that's about heathenry and Rodnoveri, which is the Slavic pagan tradition, and how it overlaps with security studies. And that should be coming out later this year. And that's me.
Well, thank you.
Thank you. It's nice to be here.
I just wonder whether we could start, Ross, by asking you, your work with Inform, obviously vital and all the, you know, to at least literally do what it says, inform the security services and people in the non-pagan sphere about what these sort of movements are like, if they're a threat or if they're just ordinary, I suppose.
Mm.
How does that overlap with your academic work?
Well, that literally they recruited me from that. So I think it was 2 years ago now, I wrote an article for the Pomegranate, which is the International Journal of Contemporary Paganism Studies. And it was a fairly innocuous article on girls, healing girls on Instagram, or girls that are play around with like heathen looking mysticism and like things like Ward Runa. There's like a, I don't even think there's a name for it. There's like a, I guess, neo folk music had a lot to do with it, and like the computer game Senua's Sacrifice. There's a lot of aesthetics like that. So I was involved with, well, I was involved. I wrote an article on that. And then and with my other work, like doing conferences and things, I was just contacted. Originally, I did a leaflet for an anti-hate group in the UK called Exit UK that work with former white separatists who've been involved in the prison system, or it advises and helps families of neo-Nazis. And so there was an overlap there between the Majesty's Prison and Probation Service and Exit UK and the Police Pagan Association, which is basically run by a police officer called Andrew Pardy. He's affiliated with Azotru UK, I think, and he's based in Hertfordshire. He's a Gothi as well, and he's doing some really interesting work for, I guess you could say, government bodies. And so he educates like civil servants and the police on pagans in general in the UK. So, for example, if you've got a situation where someone has put a kind of pagan-looking or occult-looking symbol at a crime site, normally like vandals or something, you might get a local police service that would contact Andrew Pardy and the Police Pagan Association and ask them, you know, are these Blair Witch or what is it? And the answer is, you know, generally speaking, like, this is just kids fucking around. So yeah, that's basically how it all ties together.
And from that, Ross, you're mentioning all these the perception of kids, as you say, sort of messing about or whether it's something more serious. And obviously there's the connections to Exit UK and prison and white supremacy and so on. That must be a bit of a challenge, because obviously to somebody who isn't part of that sphere, those symbols, you know, they see a hammer or they see runes, that all looks the same.
To be honest, you know, that's exactly the same discussion that we've had in heathenry though for decades. I would even say it's fundamental to the character and identity of modern heathenry, because Wicca doesn't have these conversations. I mean, all right, to be fair, Wicca does have a similar narrative or dialogue with itself and with society by saying, no, we're not witches in that way. We're not Satanists. You know, the pentagram doesn't mean child sacrifice. And it's similar to us and the way we might say, oh, we're not racists. But I think that's slightly different in heathenry, because we're the only pagan tradition that has the unfortunate relationship or association with Nazism. And Nazism is obviously the ultimate historical human experience of racism. So it's the only religion, or the religion, that is most associated with racism. And people forget that, as in people in heathenry forget that, that we are an outlier in religions in general. And it's quite a scary prospect when you put it in perspective like that. And it's only recently, the last couple of years, we've started, as we like say, educational bodies or investigative bodies in tied to governments, have only recently clocked onto this and realized like how far-reaching this issue is. Because when you look at, say, the guy that stormed the Capitol building in the US a couple of years ago, you know, with the buffalo headdress on, he was all over the news internationally, because obviously it was an international event. Like, he got into the throne room of the king of the world, and his tattoos were an Yggdrasil surrounded by runes. It was Knocknut, and I think he had a Thor's hammer as well on his chest. So those tattoos were, you know, for a lot of people who would have understood them, that's a really bad branding, you know. And it's like, we've not been able to get away from this shit since the 1930s. It's still fundamental to who we are as a little tiny micro religion.
Well, it's fascinating, because although there was various, the few sort of big orgs put out statements regarding the Q Shaman, I think he was called, or called himself.
Yeah.
There was a couple of interesting things that I spotted, and I can't find the original posts, but one of them was that people who did a quick sort of deep dive into him said he, whatever his beliefs, he seems to be some kind of Christian. That he was not a heathen by any measure. And in addition to that, one, this is obviously straight into the realms of heathens having their own conspiracy. Somebody said, it looks like those tattoos are covering up something else. He's had possibly a worse tattoo underneath.
Right.
Who on earth knows? But if you've ever seen any of the Brank interviews he's done, not the TV station, but there's a YouTube channel, I think called Channel 5 or something like that. And they did an interview, like a very, very frank, you know, no holds barred, say, you know, tell us your truth interview. And goodness me, if you thought he was odd before, his perception was quite skewed, shall we say.
Yeah, because he was part of the QAnon group, I'd say almost delusional conspiracy theory group. And that's the thing, like when you say about Christianity, I mean, I guess from a religious studies point of view, you have to be quite careful about pigeonholing things, because it gets filtered through the media, because they try and dumb it down is perhaps unfair, but they try and simplify it. And then that becomes the narrative on the street. Yeah, you might say, is this person a Christian or a heathen? If that's the question you've been asked by the media, or say like the police or something like that, you're in a tricky situation, because quite often you've only been given a binary question, like a yes or no. And we don't work like that in religious studies. I mean, for instance, if you were to kind of to change tact a little bit, but if you were to look at like the early Anglo-Saxons, are they Christian or are they heathen? You can't put them in one or the other. I mean, if you look at the artifacts from Sutton Hoo, they're clearly heathen, but the people that were burying that stuff were considered Christian by a lot of scholars until, you know, for 100 years, until scholarship recently caught up and then said, hang on, you know, we can't really call them one thing or another. And that's similar to these people today. And even in the heathen community, you know, like, where do you draw the line between someone who is a folkish heathen and someone who is just a neo-Nazi? You know, the reaction from leftists or mainstream heathens is these people are not interested in religion, they're interested in politics. And that's true. But then you've got a lot of these mainstream or leftist heathens who don't even believe in the gods. And I was one of them for many years, most of my history as a heathen. I didn't believe in the gods as, and many of us don't believe in the gods as supernatural beings, but see them more as kind of Jungian archetypes. And that's fine, you know, that's also part of heathenry. But what I mean by that is, on paper, if you were trying to look at it clinically and dispassionately, as a heathen, you were criticizing someone like the QAnon shaman for being actually Christian or actually a neo-Nazi and not heathen. And you're also criticizing Odinists for being actually, you know, macho, brohalla, and not heathen. Why is that different from a heathen who is actually an atheist? Because are you an atheist or are you a heathen? And then you get into this whole conversation about, well, what is heathenry? If you can be an atheist and heathen, is heathenry a religion?
That's almost into the realms of philosophy there, aren't you?
Yeah.
That's what we do in academia, right? I mean, it is kind of a philosophical, certainly religious studies, it is a philosophical debate constantly.
Mm-hmm. So where does that really leave your, quote-unquote, even if there is such a thing, a average heathen in the street, as it were, in terms of their perception of symbols? Because even though what I would consider fairly obvious symbols, the swastika or whatever, even other symbols I've seen people have tattooed on themselves without even researching them in any way at all. And that always surprises me.
I think you're talking about the Vig Vissir.
Vig Vissir, well, also the Aegis Hammer, is it?
Yeah, Aegis Hjalmr, the Aegir Helmet of Ore.
Yeah, the Helm of Ore.
Or Helmet of Aegir, yeah.
And I've seen people have those tattooed on, you know, permanent marking. Well, okay, these days you can have them moved more easily, but still.
Semi-permanent.
Yeah.
Yeah.
What are your thoughts on those, Ross?
As tattoos?
Well, as tattoos, as designs, they look fantastic. But in terms of people having them as symbols of their faith, you know, I'm always a bit, I don't want to say you wasted your time and money, but there are other symbols, perhaps, you know.
Obviously, when you talk about tattoos, then you're into the whole conversation about tattoos as, like you say, as a permanent mark, but, you know, or as a, you know, the whole thing of tattoos is a conversation in itself, right? But I'm not too bothered about people making permanent mistakes on their skin, because in a way that's just a physical embodiment, a literal embodiment of the permanent damage that they're doing to themselves and society by carrying around misinformation. You know, they spend years of their life not just carrying a tattoo on them, but spending their life under the misunderstanding of what heathenry is. So yeah, when it comes to symbols inside modern heathenry, I think that the big issue is one of education. And that is a real bee in the bonnet that I have as a heathen because of my academic background. So, you know, I've got into arguments in the past online. I'm a real idiot with getting dragged into, you know, a keyboard warrior and a social justice warrior, or at least I have been historically. So I've been accused of being a gatekeeper, which is hilarious to me when you've got 10 people who are admins in a group screaming at you, saying that you're a gatekeeper. When you're the one in the minority, you're clearly not gatekeeping information. They are. And what you're trying to do is provoke someone to think differently. Differently from the status quo. And the status quo in heathenry tends to be following a kind of doctrine or dogma. And for someone who's been a heathen for, God, 30 years or something, certainly pre-internet, the way I have seen heathen mainstream, if you like, relationship or concepts of heathen terms, heathen words, heathen symbols has changed dramatically. So, for instance, back in the 90s, the word for heathen was Odinist. It didn't have any connotations at all. That was the word. Then we went through a phase of heathen kind of came in, but then it was Azatru was the main word we used for many years. I think that's one of the reasons why Azatru UK is still called Azatru UK, because it was founded at kind of at that time when Azatru was the word. And in Sweden, we had the Swedish Azatru Association. But then there was this movement where an Azatru EU was founded. Then you had this movement, or I should say shift, where people started thinking, well, Asatrú is a modern Icelandic or modern Danish term. So, you know, heathen is more correct. And now heathen, I think, is widely accepted as the correct nomenclature. But you certainly have an attempt by the alt-right in the last couple of years to appropriate the word Asatrú.
I've seen another phrase that's on the rise is Norse paganism. I've seen it said, written, that, oh, well, heathen Asatrú, that's too limiting. What I do is a bit more fluid, is a bit more open. So Norse paganism fits what I'm doing.
Well, I don't like that personally as a heathen, because you are ostracizing yourself. You're tribalizing. And this is another thing that the alt-right love. They love to segregate us in our own community, and they love to tribalize us. So they even talk, you know, you have like Theod. They do the other way, and they say, we're Anglo-Saxon pagans. We don't deal with Norse pagans, as if it's a different religion. And it's really moronic, because they're obviously basing their sources on Old Norse sources. And then in some cases, just translating the word to something Anglo-Saxon where it never existed in Anglo-Saxon. So as a good example of that is, I think they use the name Bealdur for Baldur, and that isn't historical in Old English. There is a word, Bealdur, in Old English, which is cognate with Baldur, but it doesn't seem to be the word that was used historically. It was Beldag, and they don't use that because they're just badly educated. And this is the problem as an academic that I have, and I know a lot of other heathens with academic backgrounds are really beyond jaded with the level of miseducation within heathenry. And not heathens are as well. You know, non-academic heathens are really frustrated as well, because we can't find the sources that we as a community need. And that's why you've got people, to go back to your original question of the fucking massive rant that I just had, that's why people tattoo a modern grimoire symbol like the Vegvísir on them, is because there is not enough education and proper academic knowledge in heathenry. It's very, very simple.
And I can imagine it is hard, because a lot of the history was oral and wasn't written down. So we don't have books or whatever rely on.
That is what we say. That we say that in academia, and we say that in heathenry. But I've had this conversation with academics.
Uh-huh.
And the issue there is, we don't know what wasn't written down.
Ah.
So J. Stanley Hopkins is a heathen who's also an academic. I really like a lot of the things he comes out with. He runs a site called Mimis Brunner, and he started a new publishing company called Hildyr, Hyldyr. And he comes out with some great one-liners. So he really dislikes the way some heathens talk about Snorri Sturluson as being an unreliable witness because he was a Christian. Because his issue is that, yeah, sure, but when you look at the Edda, and certainly when you look at the original Old Norse, or I should say medieval Icelandic, where he's writing, he quotes constantly. He's almost like an academic. He actually had an academic process. In the Prose Edda, he is constantly backing up all his assertions with old poetry, which in some cases we know was pretty much pre-Christian. Pre-Christian, which is also a difficult, controversial term, but it was certainly before the Christianization of Iceland, so before the year 1000.
Mm-hmm.
So for heathens to be just like throwing around words like oral tradition, so we've lost all this information, have we though? Because if you look at the body of Old Norse mythology, it's quite impressive. The amount of information that we have about the Roman and Greek religions, pagan religions, we have a lot of knowledge about it. But that's because we've had people studying and researching that as part of modern Western culture. So you've had hundreds of thousands of scholars researching that. We have a comparable amount of written source material in Old Norse and Anglo-Saxon, the corpus. So you've got to be careful when you start saying, oh, we've lost all this. We don't have evidence for what we've lost, because we don't know.
Because it isn't studied yet, you say?
No, we try to study and investigate and theorize about what we've lost. We try and do that. But the problem is, you know, making an assertion about what isn't there is fundamentally fucking stupid. You can't study something that doesn't exist. So that has kind of trickled down into heathenry by saying, oh, we don't know things. Do we, though? Because when you compare it to other historical religions, dead religions, say like Greek and Roman historical paganisms, we actually know quite a lot about Germanic paganism. So I think we've got to be careful with that. One thing that we can say when we look at archaeology or archaeological remains, so like runestones or things like picture stones, which some people might call a runestone, but they don't have runes on them. They're mainly from Gotland and predate the Viking era. And they have these fascinating, really complex symbols on, or sometimes they have actual illustrative scenes on them of, say, what looks like human sacrifice, or might look like a blood or something like that, with, you know, with dudes on and ships and raven. Valknut, what people call the Valknut, that's preserved in one of these Gotland picture stones. That information that is on there, we don't know if we have that preserved in text. So that's one of the areas that you might look at, or you might look at a grave with good grave goods, and you might look at that and say, we don't think that this information that we're seeing in here has been preserved in mythology. So that's where you might say, okay, well, the meaning that is in this grave, so the meaning that is in Sutton Hoo, for instance, has been lost in oral tradition. That is a good theory. I suppose you might say the evidence is that there is information being communicated in the symbols in Sutton Hoo that we don't really have written records about. So that would be the evidence there. But even then, one of the reasons you can identify something as religious symbolism in archaeological material is because we have little hints about it in written material. So, for instance, there's a Christian accusation of Anglo-Saxon pagans in that they worship the stag and the snake. And you see the stag in the symbolism, in the grave goods at Sutton Hoo. It's even on the top of what looks like a scepter. It's often called the scepter or the whetstone. And what's really cool about that as well is that it's got four sides to it. And on each end, you have four faces, and each face is different. So it's eight altogether, which, as we know, is like a typical religious number. And there's also around, I think it's about the 10th or the 11th century, we have Slavic idols that have been recorded with four faces, with, say, rectangular object with four faces on. And that's an idol, and they seem to represent four deities, or a deity with four faces. So there is a theory there that maybe the Sutton Hoo whetstone scepter has images of gods on, and it's topped by a stag. So back in the 40s when they found it, the academic study of the scepter hadn't really tied these other things together. And they just said, oh, well, it's probably a Christian symbol because the stag occurs in the Bible or something like that. And it's only over the generation, well, the decade, that scholars have started to put one and one, or two and two together, and said, okay, this is probably a pagan symbol. But again, we go back to that conversation before and say, well, could it have been a pagan symbol that was relevant to Christians? And that is why it survived. And then you also talk about the snake. Why is the snake found in Old Norse runestones, which were made by Christians? It's all over the place. The runes are carved in a snake or a dragon. For many decades, or even, I guess, centuries to a point, it was assumed that it was Jörmungandr. And then other scholars have said, well, no, it's probably the snake as a symbol of evil in the Garden of Eden. And then now we're in the situation where we say, well, can't it be both? Maybe that is why it was used for such a long time, because it meant things to people on a very complex, nuanced level. So it touched on the mythology of heathenry, and it touched on the heathenry of the mythology of Christianity.
I'm sure there's a paper or something I read about snakes / and I'm in heavy quotes here, dragons on the eaves of houses or on the entrance or something. I remember seeing something about that, and that was a recurring motif. Why would you put it on your house? For some reason, that sort of, are they being sent up to heaven? Is it a Christian symbolism, or is it meaning something else?
This is something we don't do in heathenry. We spend most of our time talking about whether we should reclaim the swastika.
I don't do that, Ross. That's one thing I don't.
But what we don't do is, say, talk about these old symbols, like you say. So what if Jörmungandr is a kind of satanic symbol, in kind of anti-cosmological symbol, you know, a demonic symbol, if you like, in Nordic mythology. So Jörmungandr is a bad thing You know, he kills Thor, he destroys Cosmos. Then why is it all over historical heathen artwork? It's everywhere. So that is something we need as a community to really kind of, I wouldn't say meditate on, but certainly discuss and explore and research and maybe meditate on, maybe contemplate. There are a lot of these symbols in historical symbols that are just neglected. Going back to what we talked about with education, right? You know, we spend a lot of our time, say, looking at runes, and it just because those are the most shallow, obvious modern associations that we have with historical heathenry, and they're descended from Victorian archaeological finds. So that's why one of the reasons why we continue to associate horned helmets with Vikings, because in the 1800s they were finding objects with horned helmets, and they thought they were from the Viking Age, but it turned out they were from the Vendor period or from the Bronze Age. And even now, you know, I think a lot of heathens and people outside of heathenry are fully aware that Vikings did not have horned helmets. But at the same time, it's used in Viking media, you know, Viking flavor media. So you have them in films even today. You have them in computer games even today. To my horror, a couple of years ago, there was a horned Viking on the advertisement for, I think it was an American, but I think it was also associated with the Danish National Museum, which is normally excellent, by the way. If you ever get a chance to go to Copenhagen, go to the National Museum. It's amazing in regards to Viking archaeology and bog bodies, or the Bronze Age and the Vendor period. So it's amazing. But they were putting on, you know, the advertisements for the exhibition. They were using a Viking horned helmet. And it was, you know, it really upset a lot of scholars, because there were scholars involved, obviously, in the museum. And why it was decided that it was okay to use a Viking in a horned helmet, I don't know. And then it's not surprising that people have these ridiculous Victorian ideas about pagan past and within heathenry. Why we continue to have these shallow and erroneous ideas about the past. It's not really our fault, or it's not the fault of heathens in a way, it's the fault of academics.
There's also an argument that, well, not an argument, but a thing that I noticed when I sort of came into heathenry, that the sources that I could find most easily that were free, or legitimately free, shall we say, without pirating anything, tended to be old literature, which would probably be from the Victorian era, maybe some stuff from the 60s if you're lucky.
Yeah.
Mostly from Victorian stuff, or even older in some cases. So that's one side. But the other thing is, I've gone deeper and realized that those have many, many issues with them. Some are okay, some aren't. And, you know, even learning the difference is one thing. But one thing I've noticed is, as I found quite recently doing some research, was the number of sagas I couldn't find any English translation for at all. Mm. Okay, there may be later ones, but I thought, well, surely there'll be, even if I can't find them, somebody will have done it somewhere. And the number one, I literally had to run through Google Translate. I could find them, but, you know, just kind of like get a sort of garbled, run it through Icelandic. Okay, that's not right. Run it through Norwegian. That's not quite right. But you would get the gist of like a paragraph at least, or like a little sort of a verse. That was amazing to me. That to me, it's not just a matter of bad source or bad sort of historian sort of stuff from like the 19th and early 20th century, but there's other sources that people aren't even reading.
No, I mean, and that's the fault of academia. It absolutely is. I've spoken to people at Aarhus University. That's a great bunch of folks there with a really good history of study of Old Norse religion. So the current guy that mainly specializes, a fairly young guy called Simon Nygaard, or Simon Nygaard, I guess you would anglicize it as. And he's a former student of Terry Gunnell. And we've talked about this situation where there's so much in the study of Old Norse religion that, a little bit like we talked about oral tradition, that it is common knowledge. It's what we're teaching in the university courses in the study of Old Norse religion. We don't actually have textbooks for it, which is bizarre. So there's a lot of articles and PhD theses and things like that. Theories and even archaeological reports of new discoveries are not being turned into academic books that we can use on courses. So when I did my master's in what was called Viking studies in Scotland, the majority of our course material was fucking academic articles. And it was a real pain in the ass for the university because they had to pay for all these access for these different sites that controlled, that had deals with these different academic journals. It was costing, you know, a small university a hell of a lot of money just because there wasn't a publishing company that had an interest in gathering this information into a book, a textbook, and there wasn't the publishing support going to scholars, say, like Terry Gunnell or Simon Nygaard. Certainly Simon Nygaard, because Terry has his books, but Simon is not being supported with being published. And at the same time, universities cutting down on their departments. So a kind of meaningless, socially irrelevant, obscure department like the study of Old Norse religion, they're one of the first to go. So in a way, you could say it's the fault of academics, but it's not Simon's fault that heathens aren't being educated in this. He's a victim of the publication system. He's a victim of politicians who are cutting down on the state-run institutions like universities that acts in these departments. Yeah, it's really frustrating. And that is one of the reasons why you have someone like H.R. Ellis Davidson's books still being in circulation, because during that period, even post-war, you had money going to departments that were researching Germanic religion at a British university, and British publishers putting money on Germanic religion. Whereas in the last 10 or 15 years, things are really taking a nosedive like that. It's really difficult to get stuff published now.
I think with one or two notable exceptions, I would absolutely agree. I think you've got Neil Bryce's massive tomes, but how long is there between the first and second edition? It's been, what, a decade? Was it longer?
And you're right. I mean, there are always exceptions. And he's a really good exception because he was given 10 million, is it 10 million kroner or is it something ridiculous? Was it, couldn't have been 10 million euro. Maybe it was Swedish kroner then. But if you can Google it, you Google 10 million Neil Price and it will come up and tell you. But he was given a fuck ton of money to do that second version, I believe, of the book, not even the first. And to be honest, he, in the study of Old Norse religion, he's not considered academically rigorous. I mean, his book, The Children of Ash and Elm, which was his latest book, I mean, there was a hell of a lot of mistakes in there.
Yeah, there was some criticism. I saw that. I think from Jay Stanley, actually, was some of the one.
Jay Stanley Hawkins, yeah. I mean, he's quite outspoken when it comes to stuff like that. But yeah, I mean, Matthias Nordvig, he's a heathen and academic. He runs the Nordic Mythology podcast. I think he wrote and published, I'm not sure if it was on his blog or if it actually got published in a semi-academic blog or online magazine, but he wrote a really good review of it, which was fairly balanced. For my taste, it was a little bit too supportive. But the problem with that specific case with Neil Price is that he is a good scholar, you know, there's no doubt about it. I mean, he's far senior to me. So for me to say this is almost arrogant, you know. But I'll tell you the way it looks like from a student point of view is that he's been given too much money that should have been spread out to the different departments and to other better scholars, like the Swedish scholar Stefan Brink, Aberdeen. I think he's just retired now. He's published some really good books, but he hadn't been given the money to publish semi-popular books like Neil Price has. And because Neil Price is, you know, like a little bit of a poster boy, he was given too much money, and The Children of Ash and Elm was rushed through the peer review process so that it wasn't properly peer reviewed. That creates problems for academia because then we missed an opportunity there where you've got a good academic who's published good academic books, which has had an interest by amongst heathens, specifically like The Viking Way. And then the next book comes out from a bunch of publishers that have seen an opportunity here, giving the money to do a populist book, which is a dream for a professor, because then you've got a wider audience. You simplify your language, use more pictures and things like that. And people like heathens love those books. But we missed an opportunity there with The Children of Ash and Elm because a lot of it is wrong. A lot of the assertions there have been missed in peer review and were incorrect statements, which is a real shame. I think heathens are unaware of the complications of academia and the way it works and doesn't work, so that you will have an argument online. So I've been arguing for years saying, you've got to refer to modern university books. And then they'll say, well, here you go. It says in the Children of Ashenel on this. I'm like, okay, but not that one. You've got to kind of eat your words or fight, choose your battles carefully. Yeah, in some ways, things are moving in the right direction. But there are a lot of problems with academia. And academia is ultimately responsible for the lack of good knowledge, as you say, good access to good materials. And it's also responsible for the continued legacy of Victorian and, frankly, Volkish era material in the modern heathen corpus. So a classic one that does the rounds is The Cult of the Teutons, which is a two-part volume written by, is it Grönbeck?
Yeah, Grönbeck, yeah.
And he was Volkish, he was writing in the 20s and 30s. Yeah, he was an academic, yeah, sure. But he was an academic in the 1920s during the German nationalist movement. He was writing about all kinds of stuff. He did not have the academic rigor that you have today. He didn't have access to the archaeological finds that have, this was before Sutton Hoo. He was writing a lot of his books for a start, So you've got to put things in perspective as a heathen. And as heathens, we do not have critical thinking. And that is going back to symbols, that is one of the big problems that we have. It's not just the lack of education, but a lack of critical thinking. We are victims. So much of what modern heathenry is, they are symptoms of being victims of other ideologies. And it's really tragic to be a sociologist and to study contemporary heathenry, and often from my point of view, to be like a closet heathen, and to be asked by the police and say, what is the problem with heathens? Why are there so many heathens that are doing this stuff with the far right? And I have to say, it's because they don't know better, because they're being infiltrated. And the dialogue, the narrative in the heathen community is being constantly steered by the alt-right to denying the alt-right. That's exactly what the alt-right and the far-right wants. It wants us to talk about what we are not. What it doesn't want is to talk about being constructive and looking at historical material. And as I said, like kind of falsifying on it and trying to take life-changing and life-affirming information from the past, which is the claimed reason for heathenry. We claim as heathens that we are focused on nature and that we celebrate the knowledge and wisdom of the past. But what we do is we spend most of our time saying what we aren't. We are not modern political movement. Okay, great. Can we then get back to reconstructing the old religion? Apparently we can't. Apparently we don't do that.
But of course, I've seen it in other sort of heathen circles where people are now deriding the term reconstructionist. You're not one of those people who bangs on about the same old five sources. We have to go beyond that now. And I'm not quite sure where that ethos has come from again. I mean, I presume it's coming from a good place, but I don't think it's particularly helpful. You say, well, if we're not reconstructing, then what are we doing? Are we just, I mean, obviously there are gaps, but it's a difficult conversation to have.
Yeah, and I understand where that comes from. And one of the, it's a complex argument. I mean, I would call myself a reconstructionist, but I would also call myself a feminist. And that's a similar term that a lot of women, young girls I've spoken to said, oh, I'm not a feminist. As if feminism is something, like a feminazi, like, these extreme women who are, anti-man. That's not what I was raised to believe a feminist was. And that's why I would call myself a feminist. But I understand that feminism means something else to certain other people. Totally, I get that. And you have to be careful. You can't just, go around screaming, I'm a feminist. If you're not a feminist, fuck you. You have to be nuanced about this and be aware of what symbols, what words symbolize, what words communicate. And it's the same with reconstructionism. In heathenry, if you just go around screaming, I'm a reconstructionist, and if you don't like that, then you're an idiot. Okay, but what do you mean? Because this other person might see reconstructionism as meaning something else. So it's like with Odinism, you get a lot of, not a lot, I've seen it several times, where you have someone coming into a heathen group online saying, I'm an Odinist, but I'm not an Odinist. I worship Odin as my main deity. And I'm not going to let Odinists and folkish and far-right heathens take that word from me. Okay, but if you go around telling people you're an Odinist in the heathen community, you know you're going to be misunderstood, right? And they're like, yeah, but that's their problem. I'm like, no, it's not. It's your problem because you're not being sensitive to these things. And that's where we are with Reconstructionism. I definitely believe from an insider and outsider with heathenry is that it is a religion that claims to reconstruct an old religion. So I think, as you say, it's becoming more and more the doctrine in mainstream heathenry that we don't need to try to relive the old religion. We don't need to be, dress up as Vikings and chainmail or something. We don't need to focus on child sacrifice or something like that, you know, or even animal sacrifice. It's like, yeah, that's a good point, but you're still fundamentally reviving or reconstructing a historical religion. You're not coming up with new, you're not inventing new deities. You know, you're still using old words from old mythology. You know, so in that respect, heathenry is fundamentally a reconstruction or revival. It is. But sure, I accept that we are not only doing reconstruction, and how far you go to reconstruct the old religion is a really important dialogue to have. Absolutely. It is an important dialogue to say, do we need to do animal sacrifice? Because that was a fundamental part of historical heathenry. That's just a fact. Do we need to do that now? I don't know. Do we? Let's talk about it.
I think one of the reasons, perhaps, I don't know how you feel about this, Joachim, was the idea that Reconstructionists were self-appointed gatekeepers about what is and isn't heathenry. I think that was a think. So if somebody says, oh, I worship this deity, is it no evidence for that in the sources? So you can't. You're doing it wrong.
Yeah.
That seems to be the ethos behind it.
Well, when it comes to religion, I think that is a personal thing. So no one can dictate to anyone what they should or shouldn't believe. I would like to thank you both for today. Our next episode will be Ross Rant Part 2. In that episode, our special guest Ross will rant some more and share some thoughts on the future of heathenry. Topics that we will discuss are narratives versus reality, symbols and branding, real heathens and heathen-adjacent people, social media and young heathen girls on Instagram, prejudice, and the future. It promises to be another interesting episode, so please join us next time. You can find us online at theweirdthing.com and on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at theweirdthing.